What's it sweeter than MacReady when I meet her in the morning?
The morning.
With the morning glory.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you will hear reminiscences of life around North Carolina's Triangle area, written by local authors. On today's program, I'll be reading from the very first issue of the Hillsborough Historical Society's Journal, published in July 1998. Featuring memories of Clarence Jones. Beginning in 1964, and continuing with several interruptions until late in 1995, shortly before his death, Clarence Jones wrote his weekly sketches under the familiar banner Hillsborough Observer. The first decade, 1964 to 1974, of these articles that were contributions to the News of Orange are included in this chapter. The first edition of the Hillsborough Observer, on January 30, 1964, was a curious mixture of local gossip, seen around town recently, Roland Stubbins of Efland, etc. News, badly needed renovations at the post office have been completed. Politics, we can't agree with those who think Richardson Pryor will win the nomination for governor. Humor, at a recent meeting of the Chapel Hill and Hillsborough J.C.'s, the C.H. boys loud as how they wanted to share everything with their brother club. They offered to give Hillsborough one half of the Chapel Hill demonstrators. And a clipping we had put away some years ago that we got a kick out of, and hope you do too. The clipping had been written by Tom Anderson and was entitled Straight Talk. From this undated piece, Clarence quoted, "When I was a boy, chills used to run up and down my spine every time I heard Dixie. They still do. Robert E. Lee was always my number one hero. He still is, with Thomas Jefferson a close second. It used to irritate me, hearing the G.I.s referred to as Yanks. It still does." Most of Clarence's subsequent columns followed this same format. Chatty news of local folks, followed by a wry commentary on politics. At all levels, an occasional good story he'd recently heard. And, whenever possible, a slice of history, as only he could tell it. Sometimes he included bits and pieces of articles that he had read, as in the Anderson clipping noted above. But if he did so, Clarence expected the reader to understand his motives. In one case, where he reprinted a portion of a Durham newspaper editorial, he simply let the ignorance and bigotry of the passage speak for itself. On other occasions, he only needed to add an appropriate biblical passage to make his point. Clarence understood that he was standing at the crossroads between the Old South of Tom Anderson's lament and the New South of toleration and acceptance. Frequently, Clarence wandered back and forth between these two worlds, connecting a precious past to an ever-changing present. His wonderful wit and rich, honest prose at times served as a kind of balm to ease the pain and shock of change for everyone. His homespun style often reached deep into the hearts of his fellow Southerners, and at the same time conveyed the character and integrity of the region to newcomers. Clarence was acutely aware of the fact that change was inevitable, whether it be the obliteration of a historic fixed site or the alteration of a social relationship. Invariably, he searched for and found humor in such situations. February 6, 1964. "Things are really happening around here these days. Just listen to this. The Bill Lynches have a new house. The Fred Claytors have a new quarterback. The Nellie Gray Lipscombs have a new cheerleader. Pat Clayton has a new wife. And the Little River Church, a new preacher. The curbing being installed at the agricultural building is a wonderful improvement. And the telephone building next door is beginning to look good. We hope they will fill in Branch Gully and extend the sidewalk. Several miles out south on Old 65 lives friend Wendy Bill Ira Ray. Known far and wide as a likable, friendly character, Wendy Bill lives in an area sometimes referred to as Joppa. We don't know how or when this name was put on this section of the county, with its undefinable borders, and which vaguely stretches southward from the southern's tracks. However, Mr. Paul Collins claimed that Joppa started at the Eno River, and he lived on it. Anyway, we remember that Mr. Ed Dixon, who lived at what is now known as Mrs. Few's Place, or Johnston's Headquarters, was often pokingly referred to as Mayor of Joppa, a seaport town in the Bible where Peter raised up Dorcas from the dead. Now, back to Wendy Bill Ira Ray, who told friends that one real cold night recently, he heard something tapping on his back porch. He said that when he went out to investigate, it was so cold that the thermometer wanted to come in the house. Fortunately, Clarence loved to recall fond memories in nearly perfect detail. How else would we know about fancy milkshakes? February 4, 1965. Fancy milkshakes don't seem to have gone by. We remember when young sports used to saunter up to the fountain of Dave Paris's drugstore and say, "Give me a chocolate malted shake with ice cream and a yeast cake." This would cost 20 cents, and if a fella had a nickel more, he could have a raw egg whipped in with the rest of the stuff. Glory be, we're actually drooling. Max Browning used to say that a chocolate malted would give a fellow a bass voice for a few minutes. Perhaps Clarence was at his best when eulogizing a friend. It is in these columns where his enormous capacity for understanding his fellow man is most evident, and where his portrayal of individuals lead us to appreciate their role in the larger history of the town. February 11, 1965. Brunus Cole, 68, of Burlington, was buried in the Hillsborough Cemetery Sunday afternoon. Brunus was a native of Orange County and spent most of his life in the old town. His father, Steve Cole, operated a store on the corner of Churton and King, and was accidentally electrocuted while supervising some repair work on the roof of the building. Mrs. Steve Cole operated the Cole House, a boarding-type hotel on King Street, which is now the remodeled home of Police Chief and Mrs. George Hunt. Mrs. Hunt is a sister of Brunus, as was Mrs. Cliff Ray. Brunus, or B.C., as some called him, operated Chevrolet and Pontiac dealerships here, moving to Burlington in 1941 to open his Pontiac dealership as Cole Motor Company. Perhaps he acquired an interest in the auto business from his older brother, O.P., who opened here the first garage in the county and owned one of the first automobiles in the area. Brunus loved music and sang tenor in the local Presbyterian choir, and then later in the First Presbyterian Church at Burlington. During the 1920s, he organized a band which played around the state and over the radio, WPTF. Yes, sir, Brunus was a big man with a heart even bigger, and a personality that warmed one like an open hearth fire. At every opportunity, he came back to the old hometown to greet his friends. When he passed that big hand around, all who grasped it understood the meaning of friendly sincerity. Brunus could have lived half his life in Cadiz, Brisbane, or Hong Kong. It wouldn't have mattered. He would have remained as he was, a Hillsborough boy. Clarence's powers of observation were what fueled many of his articles. At times, the items he commented on may have seemed trivial or unimportant, but in retrospect, they're valuable historic markers of events and changes, often too subtle to have been recorded elsewhere. They also provide a vivid picture of the community as he saw it. March 25, 1965. They are tearing down the old John Sharp house on Tryon Street. Our grapevine says that Norris Sharp will build a duplex on the lot. Things we've noticed lately. Those beautiful Rhode Island red hens in Lawton Pettit's backyard. A few cars parked raggedly at the P.O., indicating the drivers take poor aim at those parking spaces, or else can't really drive. The McAnallys, who bought Piedmont Packing, moving into Burnside. Colonel Moon back in circulation, after being away several weeks. More saddle horses around. Dealer B.P. Stollard, of Old 86 South, says that business is the best it's ever been. And on April 1, 1965, 4 new houses going up across the road from the waterworks, mud again filling up the dam area at Ben Johnston Lake, that hole in the pavement at the P.O. getting larger and deeper day by day. S.C. Hughes of Okeechobee on his daily walking trip to town. The pretty brick in Ewell Liner's newly cleaned building. Many local industrial employees playing golf at Marvin Ray's. Clarence Jones was an early advocate of the aims of the recently, 1962, organized Hillsborough Historical Society, of which his wife, Margaret, was a charter member. He took an abiding interest in all things historical, and was quick to recognize the need to preserve vanishing structures and monuments of the area's rich heritage. A few weeks ago, we visited the very old Eno Presbyterian Churchyard and Cemetery. A worthwhile project is underway to reclaim the site, which dates back to the founding of the Eno Church in 1755, Leffler and Wager. We saw fresh stumps up to a foot in diameter scattered among the graves of early settlers. Some of the family names on the markers are familiar to the area, and a few are no longer identified with Presbyterianism. Since the brush has been cut away from the grounds, periwinkle is beginning to come back in vigorous fashion. Interested? Drive out 86 to the Cedar Grove turnoff at Villine's store. It is a short distance to Sam Dark's, a creek, headwaters of the Eno, and a left turn on a road through the woods which dead-end at the site. One of the identifying features of Clarence's stories is that they invariably have a punchline that bespeaks a kind of simple country wisdom. April 8, 1965. The other day we drove out to see our rural friend, Old Charlie. We hadn't seen him in a good while because there's a big mud hole between Coon Creek Road and his house down in the woods. The kind of weather we have had this spring just put Old Charlie's house out of bounds. Well, anyway, we found that our old friend had come through the winter in good shape, in spite of being a widower and a poor cook. We sat on an old bench around on the sunny side of the weather-beaten house, and sort of caught up a little bit on our visiting. On the way back to town, we got to thinking about one thing Old Charlie had said. "Well, now, I'll just tell you, it is a whole lot harder to find a good bird dog than a good wife." We wondered why he had said that. The car hummed along. Then we just shrugged our shoulders and said to ourselves, "Well, Old Charlie ought to know. He's had about two or three of each." In April, the town came alive with preparations for the Historical Society's Spring Home and Garden Tour, an event that Clarence chronicled with a good deal of well-earned pride. April 22, 1965. The hustle and bustle around town in preparation for the Old Homes Tour this weekend makes us think back to the early days of the tours. It must have been about 1948 that we remember the tour headed up by Norfleet Webb. The idea of open houses was somewhat new at the time, although we had heard that Mrs. Cheshire Webb and Mrs. A. H. Graham had headed some type of open house around 1939. Well, anyway, North Webb really turned on the steam and jawboned the local store and homeowners to clean up and paint up. Truckloads of debris were hauled out of back alleys and yards. Also, we remember that signs with the words "Welcome Pilgrims" were in every store window and everywhere else, and the pilgrims really came. Sam Kirkland was a bachelor then, but he arranged for Air Mount to be open. It was just a plain old country home, but each time it has been shown since, it has grown in beauty and elegance. Some years later, Norfleet Webb moved to Leesburg, Florida, but he left his mark here of his accomplishments. And how did Old Charlie respond to the tour? "Our country friend, Old Charlie, was in town the other day, and as we stood on the street and talked, we asked him if he was coming to the tour. He said he was afraid a fellow in overhauls would be out of place in these fancy houses. Besides that, he felt sure that the Episcopal Cemetery was the prettiest place in Hillsboro, and he could meander in there when he felt like it, and it was free. With that, old Charlie started walking up the street, but turned, threw up his hand, and said, "Come out and see me," and we knew he meant it. In our book, old Charlie, with his iron gray hair, is all wool and a full yard wide. One of the most impressive properties of the area in the early 20th century was Okonichi Farm, the home of Julian Carr, and in 1965, Clarence delivered a detailed account of the estate. June 3, 1965. They are getting ready to tear down what was known on Okonichi Farm as the Big House. Yes, the Harold Culbreths are building a nice new home immediately behind the old Julian S. Carr summer home. Word has it that when the new house is completed, the present one will be removed. An era has passed. Back in the teens, Okonichi Farm was a showplace unequaled in this and surrounding states. We remember there was a picture of it in a grammar school geography book. A typical Piedmont NC farm. Of course, that subtitle was ludicrous, because it was the most untypical farm in the southeast U.S. What did they raise on this rich man's dream farm? Racehorses, sheep, magnificent Holstein cows, the first ever seen in this area, three or four varieties of chickens in houses unequaled anywhere, ducks, geese, turkeys, pigeons, guineas, peafowls, monkeys, parrots, birds of paradise. Of course, there were crops like grain, hay, cotton, garden produce, and an orchard that made people's eyes pop. Every year, Okonichi dominated exhibits at the state fair. The slate-roofed three-story horse barn was something to see. Some of the stall nameplates are now on the walls of the General Sherman restaurant. That magnificent palace of a barn would today cost $100,000, and the dairy barn was a mate to it. The farm was so big it had a private railroad siding at the orchard, which was the area now occupied in part by White Furniture and Heinz Liner Company. It was to this siding came the trains bringing hundreds of tourists and picnickers to see the sights. Tables were provided in the grove where G. Coleman and Douglas Batten now live, and around the mineral spring, which is now the property of S. C. Hughes. A cedar lane ran from the big house and the adjacent clubhouse to the back side of the Winder Webb place, now Jim Cheshire, where it joined the dark walk and on into town. This was a busy walkway for visitors, residents, and hired help. After all, Carr's farm meant a lot to the economic life of Hillsboro. Mr. Carr's increasing years and declining fortune brought an end, a sad end, to a wonderful institution. Now an auto racetrack, Cotton Area, and Mountain View, the 100-acre field, has replaced the horse track and the Farmers' Livestock Exchange. Soon there won't be anything left except the big stone gateway across from White Furniture. We suppose it does all work out for the best, but it really was a fabulous farm, even though some of you who never saw it probably can't believe all you hear about it. Some of Clarence's briefest columns also contained some of his most profound opinions. One such pithy statement appeared in August of 1965. August 19, 1965. The retail business hereabouts is reported to be excellent, and the farmers' crops appear to be above average. The Great Society, whether we approve of some elements of it or not, rolls along with its wheels well lubricated with American dollars. We the people, in spite of Vietnam, race riots, and the loyal opposition, are mainly concerned with what new gadget we shall buy next. In the day of prosperity, there is a forgetfulness of affliction. Ecclesiastes 11:25. Old Charlie was a welcome commentator in the Hillsboro Observer. In fact, his Cracker Barrel philosophy was always a special feature of Clarence's musings about his fellow man. Clearly, Clarence enjoyed the old man's ramblings and was constantly on the lookout for a gem of wisdom to impart to his readers. September 2, 1965. Sometimes, when we get bored, we like to drive out and see our rural friend, Old Charlie. This particular day, it was hot as you-know-what, and we found our friend loafing on a bench on the shady side of the house. That old bench moves around the house with the seasons. It all depends on whether you want sun and warmth or shade and breeze. We sat and talked kind of easy and really made no effort to impress each other. After all, Old Charlie and we know each other too well for that type of boredom anyway. Out in front of us was a big old pear tree, and every now and then a big ripe one would let go and go plop. It was a lazy man's conversation, but as usual, Charlie came up with a good one. There are two kinds of men I don't like. One makes out he don't know nothing, and the other lets on as to how he knows just about everything. From 1965 until 1973, Clarence Jones set aside his pen in order to devote all of his boundless energy to his business and to community service. Though he was defeated for re-election as county commissioner in 1964, he was named Citizen at Large in order to assume the chair of the Research Triangle Planning Commission, which later expanded to become the Triangle J Council of Governments. In addition, he was named chairman of the Orange County Race Relations Committee, a role which was greatly responsible for the remarkably smooth integration of races in the county. Clarence resumed his column on March 11, 1973, with this brief explanation. After a lapse of some years, this column has become reactivated. We will try to pick up the little pieces of news and human interest that the big writers miss. We know that a few old readers will be glad, some mad, and the great in-between won't give a hoot. Anyway, here goes. Later that month, he wrote, March 22, 1973. During the heavy rains we had a few weeks ago, the old Eno got about as high as it ever has, according to our informants. However, we've heard that a way back, the river got so high that they had to tie Albert Browder's house to trees to keep it from floating off. His was the last house on Churton Street, on the east side, and on what is now the Courthouse Green. Old-timers will remember that Albert was a cobbler, and at one time had a shop in Brown's Livery Stable Building, at 122 South Churton. His children living now are Buck, Hubert, and Mrs. Ethel Goldsby. Mrs. Engstrom and Clarence were both very much interested in Hillsborough's history, yet their differing roles as historians is well understood from the following pieces. March 29, 1973. Last week, a little group of the DAR gathered on the lawn of the Nash Hooper place and set out a dogwood in memory of William Hooper, one of the men from North Carolina who signed the Declaration of Independence. Mrs. Engstrom gave a very interesting account of the life of this man who died there in the house, now owned by Mr. and Mrs. Cecil Sanford, and was buried nearby. Hooper departed this world embittered, leaving few friends and fewer dollars. It would appear he considered himself a failure, and yet today in North Carolina history he is one of the great. It takes a larger mind than mine to understand why we human beings so often reserve our appreciation for those who are separated from us by great hunks of time and distance. Paul and Judy Williams' home, Twin Chimneys, looks real nice in its new suit of yellow. We bet this old house is in better condition now than when it was the post office. Do you remember? We don't either. It appears that it was 1873 to 82, when the place belonged to some of the Strayhorn family, according to information supplied by Alan Lloyd. One of Clarence's classic columns appeared in July of 1973. It might well have been entitled The Great Hillsborough Earthquake, if titles had been used for his articles, and, like many of his best stories, it involved a fine mixture of history, personal family recollections, interesting asides, and, of course, humor. July 5, 1973. In 1886, there was an earthquake in Charleston, South Carolina, that killed 41 people and destroyed most of the town. These earth tremors were very definitely felt in Hillsborough, and although we find no record of material damage, the shaking scared the daylights out of people hereabouts. We've been told that an uncle living in our house had everyone go outdoors for a while because he feared the house might fall down. It didn't. As a matter of fact, the Orange County property evaluators, by their figures, seem to think that it is in mighty good shape today. When we were growing up, Winder Webb lived with three maiden sisters where the Jim Cheshires now reside. Although he courted Miss Bessie Kirkland for 30 years or so, they were never married. We remember him as a tall, stately gentleman with white hair and white mustache, well-dressed, and most gallant toward the ladies. Webb's store was quite an institution, and occupied the big brick building that is now lived in by Central Carolina Bank. They sold everything from ladies' hats to farm wagons, and from black-eyed peas to country hams. Winder Webb and Cheshire Webb operated this business, and we remember that Jack Roach, Claudia Sharp, Harlan Coleman, and Lewis Davis worked there. Also, during summertime and odd times, Marion Roberts drove the delivery wagon. In those days, it seemed that every boy had to have a nickname. Marion's friends renamed him Croaker, in honor of the little mule that pulled the wooden-bedded wagon. Some of Dr. Roberts' close friends still call him Croaker, and he doesn't seem to mind. After all, many boys have been named for a president, but we don't know anyone else who has been named for a mule. Now, getting back to Winder Webb, we understand that he kicked around quite a bit in his young days, and was known as a fun-loving sport. Well, a short time after the Charleston quake, Winder and some of his cronies buried a keg of blasting powder in a gully on Gallows Hill. We figure this was somewhere around the present location of the town water tank. Those guys laid out a long trail of powder for a fuse, lit it, and went home. The blast that followed just about knocked everybody in the area out of bed, and darned near created panic. Tales went around about mares dropping foals prematurely, and wells going dry. Dogs barked for 2 or 3 days. We've been told that for weeks, little knots of people stood about the street corners and talked about the Hillsboro earthquake. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Triangle Yesteryear is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.
I think I wish and hear what I say. Nothing could be finer than to be in Carolina in the morning.